Here's Pat.
Precious Pat. Hi, y'all.
Hi.
I'm going to take this away. Forgive my voice. I've had laryngitis for about a week now. And but I'm much better. I think I sound much better than I did when I even got here. My name is Patty Latascio, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not a and a anything. I'm an alcoholic. And which means I'm totally screwed. And I'm a member of the Pockets of Enthusiasm Big Book Study, and we meet in the city of Chicago at LaSalle on Elm Street every Tuesday at 7:30, and please bring your book with you. If you don't, we fine you $1 for being immature and irresponsible by leaving your book at home. That ought to tell you a little bit about the kind of message you're going to hear about today. This is not going to be a kissy kissy, lovey lovey message. The spiritual or no. And my sobriety date, by God's grace, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 3 legacy, and the 12 concepts of service, a loving sponsor, and a home group that I love, is February the 8th, 1977, and for that I am so grateful. And, I've heard speakers say before they don't say that to impress you, but that impresses the hell out of me. I mean, it does, because I never thought that. I always thought I was going to be one of the poor unfortunates. I really did. And I want to tell you exactly why I thought I was going to be one of the poor unfortunates. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I'm a little Southern girl, was in the city of Chicago, January 1959. And I never left AA. People said, well, did you go in and out? No, I never left AA. I just went to a meeting every night, went home, got drunk every night, one day at a time, you know? I went to prison 5 times, see? Texas, Virginia, and Florida. And I went to AA meetings when I went to prison. I went to the nut house. They used to put me in the nut. Today they call them treatment centers. Back then they called them nut houses, see? Now they charge you, what, $18,000, but now it's treatment centers. Then it was nut houses in those days. And they kind of throw you in this wacko ward, you know. And in those days, they started letting AA people come in. Let's see, what else have I done to try to cure myself of this disease? Oh, I used to think that my motto in life should be live better electrically. I had 26 electric shock therapy treatments too, you know. And that was in the days before they gave you Valium to bring you down. They used to just grease your forehead, zap it on them, you know. And your best friend in the whole world was the guy that held your chin and stuck the dirty sock in your mouth, you know, so you wouldn't bite your tongue. But so I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, and I think people get the mistaken impression that you have to be sober to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it helps. It helps. But you don't have to be sober to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same way you don't have to be abstinent to be a member of OA. See? Well, I've been a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous since January 1959. I had a hell of a desire to stop drinking. Just couldn't do it for a long, long time. But like every one of you sitting in the room tonight, including, and by the way, it wouldn't have bothered me if this beautiful Al-Anon would have chaired this meeting. It just was kind of, oh, you know, one of those kind of dealies. I'm of the opinion if you can't smell them, you can't tell them, you know? This is my personal opinion. I don't speak for AA as a whole, although I secretly think I do. They're far crazier than we are, you know. At least we had the pain reliever in us. All they had was just total insanity, 365 days a year, you know, all those years. I wouldn't have put up with my bullshit for 5 not. So I'm so glad that they're both here today. I think that's neat. And I'm glad that the Al-Anons and the lovers and friends and relatives have come out to this convention in full force to support us and themselves. Before I get started any further, this is the book Alcoholics Anonymous, although I do look like a Southern Baptist, don't I, with that book under my arm this morning going to breakfast. But I got to tell you, they gave me this nice cover in Fort Smith, Arkansas. A guy in prison made it, so that's what makes it kind of special to me, because I was in prison for so many years. Anyway, I'm going to read my disclaimer. I always read this part from the podium, and that means that y'all can't come up later and take my inventory. It is. I found this quite a while ago, and this is it. If you want to come up and take my inventory later on, you know what I'm going to say to you? What's the big word, Lisa? Fuck off. It's on page 29 of the second and third editions, and it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So I'm not up here this morning to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like. Now I'm supposed to tell you how I developed my relationship with God. That's what I'm supposed to do if I'm telling you my story. Then it says, a paragraph down, it says, we hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages or hear our stories. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So I'm going to tell you today how I developed my relationship with God. See? Now, the first God I ever had was alcohol. That, you know, if I'm going to talk about God in my life, I better tell you about the thing that worked. The first thing in my life that ever worked. The first thing in my life I could ever count on. The first thing in my life I could ever depend on. Because like you, I was one of those motherless children. I didn't fit in anywhere. And I've talked to enough alcoholics over the years, and you've let me know that you felt the same way. And no matter who you were, or what skin color you were in, or what sex you were, or anything, you just didn't belong anywhere. I don't care if you were a fat little Jewish kid in Brooklyn, you know, or a weird out God Almighty in Evansville, you know, whatever it was, you know, you just didn't belong. And I felt the same way. There's a scene in one of the old, I think it's Christmas Carol, one of those Christmas Carol old movies, and there's this kid looking in, it's snowing outside, and it's winter, and he's looking in the shop, and inside the shop are cookies and cakes and sweets and gooses and ducks and chickens. And he's looking in with his little nose pressed against the glass. And that's how I felt about life. I was always on the outside looking into life. I was always a spectator and never a participant in life. And I was an ugly, to me, I was an ugly, shy, frightened little girl. And that's the person that found alcohol. I could tell you some horrendous stories. I never talk about my family as being dysfunctional. First of all, in order to be dysfunctional, they had to have been a family. My mother was a street whore who lived or fucked around with this man for a couple of months and wound up pregnant, and he left. And you know what he told me one time? He didn't even know her name. He didn't even know her name. Her name was Noble Daughter of Grey. I am Noble Daughter of Grey Duff. And her name was Marilyn Virginia Grey Duff. And the reason she was named Marilyn Virginia Grey Duff is because my grandfather never knew whether they were in the state of Maryland or the state of Virginia when she was born. She was born outside. So they named her Marilyn Virginia Grey Duff. and I'm noble daughter of Great Elm. That's my original name. And then the federal government came along when I was a little girl and changed my name to Patricia Ann Gray. I'm always, geez, I never had a family. I had this woman who was supposedly my mother who suffered from the disease of alcoholism. And she was really full-blown when I was born, and I almost died when I was born, and they call it fetal alcoholic syndrome now. But in those days, a baby would go into convulsions. That's what little Patty Ann went into convulsions, you know. That's what they told me. And I was always a sickly child. Anyway, I didn't have a house or a bathroom or a refrigerator or ice box. I was born in 1939 in the city of Washington, D.C. The place that I can remember growing up the most around, the little one room we had outdoor plumbing in the city of Washington, D.C. in the 1940s. I never took a bath. I never knew what a bath was. I never saw a sheet or a mattress or a pillow or a pillowcase. My mother brought men home, and my sister and I would sit up all night and watch what they were doing. Sometimes she brought one man home, and sometimes she brought three or four men home. And most of the times they would beat the hell out of her, rape my sister, and then they started on me when I was about four years old. So my idea of the world was that that was normal. And you know, when you try to convince a little girl or a person coming into Alcoholics Anonymous about what is normal and abnormal, you got to remember that they've lived in a world all their lives thinking this abnormal, horrendous state is normal. So there's a gal here, Barb, that's working with a newcomer. We've been taking her inventory all weekend. I love it. See, we've been ganging up on her and picking on her. See, trying to see that her life is unmanageable. A lot of newcomers, when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, don't know how fucked up they are until they stay around a while. They don't know that life out there was abnormal. The people don't live that way, you know? So anyway, here's this little girl growing up thinking all this was normal. When I was 9 years old, one day, and it was just like that, one day, I got snatched out of that existence and put in with this man who called himself my father. I remember this man, this beautiful man. He was so, I had never seen a man so dressed like that. And I had never seen a room like this. It was a courtroom. I didn't know it at the time. I had never seen a room like this. And this man smelled good. That was the only thing I can tell you about this man, who I know today was a judge. And he held me. He held me and he says, little girl, do you want to go live with your father? And I remember the exact words I said to him. I said, what's a father? What's a father? I didn't know men were fathers. Men were nasty people who you got money from and food. And in order to get the money and the food, you had to get hurt down there or back there. That's what men were. So I went to live with my father. And every night I would lay in my little bed in this mansion. My father was so wealthy. God, it was so, I mean, you can't believe. My bedroom was the size of this room. I had a room the exact size of this. In the next room, that was my sitting room with my own fireplace, I had my own private bath, and my black mama had quarters off of my area. My walk-in closet was as big as my bedroom is today at home. My father was a big mafia who got to this country in 1908 at the age of 18 years of age. And I lay there every night. Now, here's the sick mind. The reason I tell you all this is to tell you about how alcohol saved my life, how the God alcohol saved my life. I don't badmouth alcohol. I'm not one of these alcoholics going to tell you that everything I ever did that was bad or horrendous was because of alcohol. That's a goddamn lie. And I'm sorry to see that get spread around in AA today. Well, you know, we alcoholics, we want to give alcohol a bad name. The only thing alcohol did was save your ass to get you here, keep you alive, and keep you sane enough to get your ass here, to get help. So here I was laying in the bed, and I was mad at this woman who was my mother, because we didn't even know the name mother in those days. But what I missed most was my sister Tina, who was 4 years older than myself. And my mother is 6 foot. My sister Tina is 6'1". They're physically beautiful women. My mother is dead now, wet brain, died in 1980. And Tina is not an alcoholic. Anyway, I was missing them, and I was so mad because usually they didn't give women away in our tribe until you started bleeding. They would wait till you started bleeding to give you away to men, and they hadn't even waited till I started bleeding to give me away to a man. And I waited for the first 2 years every night for this man whose name was Father. I thought that was his name, Father. I didn't know that Father denoted a relation to a child. I was waiting for him every night to come and get into bed and do the things to me that men did to little girls and women. That's what I did. I didn't talk to anybody, and when I talked, I stuttered. And I have such a terrific speech impediment. And it's horrendous to have to open your mouth and have 5 minutes to be able to take to say, I have to go to the bathroom. And it takes 5 minutes for you to get all those things out. And by the time you're doing that, you're peeing your little pants. So that Patty is the person that was right for the god alcohol. I tell you a little bit about me. I went to live with my father at 9. They found out I was dying of malnutrition, tuberculosis, and I had rickets so bad that my legs were so bent that I couldn't even stand up. It was very hard for me to stand up. I have beautiful legs today, real straight, because I had to lay in those damn braces. At night when I got in the bed, they put the high-top shoes on me, and the braces went all the way up to my waist. And once a month, the doctor and the nurses would tighten the braces and bring the crooked, bowed legs in a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and it hurt. It hurt going to bed every night. I hated going to bed every night because going to bed at night meant pain. So I was in the TB sanitarium, and then for 6 months, I was out. I had complete bed rest. So the first year with my father was in the bed. I very seldom saw him. Who I saw was my beautiful stepmother, whom I adore. She's dead. And my step-grandmother and my black mama, Sarah. And Sarah became my mother. And she was like the best first AA sponsor anybody could have ever had. She told me, she said, you know, girl, you act like no account white trash. Because I had the language of the streets. This beautiful woman who was my stepmother used to come in and she was going to teach me how to read and write. And I'd go to say something nice to her because she was so lovely. She was, and beautiful. God, you look like Claudette Colbert. She was beautiful. And I'd open my mouth and say something to her. I thought I'd said something nice. And she'd get all red in her cheeks. She was a southern lady, you know. She'd get all, I'd probably say, how the fuck are you, you know, or something like that. And she'd get all red in her, you know, hey, bitch, you know, what's going on, you know. And she'd get all red in her face, and she'd go running out. And I think, God, that's a crazy bitch, man. I was just trying to be nice to her, you know. And I didn't understand. You know, sometimes we expect children to act like miniature adults. They're not. The children. I think we place far too much expectation on our children today. My God, we make them so competitive, but that's my personal opinion. But we make them so competitive today. Jesus Christ, at 2 years old going to Montessori. God Almighty, why don't we let them be kids? Why don't we let them be kids poop in their pants? Who cares how long they poop in their pants? You know? I mean, why do they have to be potty trained at 6.5 months now, you know? Pretty soon we're going to get a monitor back there, and every time you pass a little gas and get ready to make a bowel movement, it's going to go beep, 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 and Mama's going to put them in the pot. I swear, we're just getting so sterile with our children. How the hell we get off on that? Anyway, we got to get spiritual here. Every time my home group hears I'm the Sunday morning speaker, they laugh so hard. They can't even talk. They're laughing so hard. You? You, the spiritual speaker. Well, you got them bastards buffaloed. Okay. So I started school when I was 10 years old. Now, I have to tell you two things that's got me screwed up. One thing in particular that got me screwed up and really kept me screwed up for a lot of years. And from what I understand, Rick reminded me, I did a workshop at the Gay Roundup in Chicago. It was on sex and relationships. And it was pretty loaded. It was a big meeting. And there was a couple, maybe 300 people there that day. And I stood up and I said, my name is Patty, and I'm going to talk about homosexuality in the Bible. It's a mistake. It's been a printing mistake on the program. And you never saw so many evil-looking eyes staring at you. Well, that old Indian, she had professed to be a Southern Baptist, and every time she stopped drinking, the first thing she did, two things, that Indian. First thing she did was send us to the Grace Baptist Church. Second thing she did was clean everything in that one little place. And my sister and I, you couldn't wait for her to get drunk again. God, she was a pain in the ass. But we didn't mind going that Grace. I didn't mind going. I used to stand up on the back row, way in the back, and the preacher man, he'd be rocking and rolling, playing the side trombone when the saints come marching in, and on the hill far away stands an old rugged cross, cha-cha-cha. And he'd be wailing on the slide trombone. His wife was over there playing the honky-tonk piano, you know. She's just an old roly-boly little woman, you know. And I knew that they had never been sanctified all their lives. I knew they had been sinners before they got sanctified. Because every once in a while after a song, she'd be playing the piano and she'd go, and do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, with her hand like that. And I thought, she plays like the honky-tonks. Anyway. He'd stand up and he'd say, who amongst you is a sinner? And see, this alcoholic, cunning, baffling, powerful mind used to stand up in the back of the church and hear, here, preacher man, here I am. And I'd stutter it, but I could say, here I am. And he'd say, God bless you, child. Give that kid an extra donut. Well, when you're starving out on the street, you'll admit any goddamn thing. You know? You know, we talk, thank God, in gay AA, they both sides talk about whoring. In straight AA, it's only the women that are whores, you know. You know? But I tell the guys in straight AA, Jesus Christ, you go to work every day, and the boss man says, do something. You don't want to do it. You bend over and say, yes, sir, boss, I'm going to do it. We got a lot of legal whores in the United States. Did you know that? Legal whores. They call themselves wives. Oh. It's Thursday night. Tomorrow's payday. Guess who's going to get lucky tonight, whether a son of a bitch needs it or not? Because she wants a new microwave. She's been a bitch for 2 weeks, but she wants a microwave. Guess who's going to get it tonight, whether he needs it or not? See? Not a legal whoring. How did we get on that one? Anyway. I got to get spiritual. Anyway. So I went to live with my father, and all of a sudden, I'm 10 years old, and the doctor says she's well, she can get up, she can walk around, and I started hearing my mother and father whisper. You know how people behind closed doors discuss alcoholics, behind how the family gets together, and they talk about us. It, you know, what are we going to do about it? Well, and they were talking about what are we going to do about Patty Ann. And they started mentioning words like discipline, she's incorrigible, and I knew, I didn't know what those words meant, but I knew somehow it did not sound good to me. And so I heard the word Catholic schools. Now, I went to Catholic schools before Vatican II. When nuns look like nuns and they acted like nuns instead of like some whores out on the street today, you know. I'm telling you, it's getting harder and harder to tell the nuns from some of the girls down on Roosevelt Road in Chicago. Gee, I tell Sister B that all the time. She doesn't like to hear that shit. And the first day I went to Catholic schools, I was standing there just, and the only reason I'm going into this is because I don't think this is, I'll end it on time, don't worry, we'll get out of here on time. And because this, I want you to know about the screwed up little girl that picked up this God alcohol that saved my life. The first thing in Catholic schools, it was they put me in the, I was 10 years old, they put me in the fifth grade. I didn't know how to read or write, they put me in the fifth grade because I was 10 years old. And the nun comes in and everybody jumps up out of their chair. And it was, good morning, sister. And it was like little toy soldiers. And this man, this impressed me. I was just looking around, I was sitting down in my chair. And the nun said, Tarantino, up. And I said, hey, bitch, you talking to me? And the next thing I know, I was on the floor bleeding from my nose and my ears and my mouth. And she was only 4'11". I think they go to martial arts school in the old days, you know? And as I got up off the floor, I looked at her and I said, what the fuck did you do that for, man? And ba-boom, I was down on the floor again. Now, I have to tell you that I'm a street person. I'm a street person. And when you're out on the streets, some of you guys and girls know that, when you're out on the streets, you've got to be a quick study, because if you're not, they're going to eat you alive. And I thought, every time I get up off the floor, she knocks me down again because I opened my mouth. Maybe I should keep my mouth shut and then get up, you know? So I did. But by the time that day was over, I damn near got killed. And I was just being nice. Right? So I marched up 6th Street Hill to my father. My father was home that day. And I walked up to his office. He had a big, beautiful office in our home. And I pulled up my dress and I pulled down my panties. And there was big welts all on my hiney and big welts all on my hands. And I had blood coming out of my nose. And I said, you see that motherfucking bitch did to me, man? And he said, well, what did you do? What happened? Tell me. So I told him the whole story. I didn't leave anything out. And he proceeded to give me a beating worse than the nun had given me. And he said in his best broken English, disgrazione, don't you ever disgrace me again. And he let me know that he was Smokey Joe Tarantino. He was the head of the family of Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and I was never, ever to bring disgrace upon him or his name again. And he beat me, and I learned a valuable lesson that day. I learned, number one, never talk back to the nun, and that started translating in don't talk back to authority. I'm a smart cookie. I am really smart. Well, I'll get you, but I won't talk back to you. It's like cops. They don't talk back to them. Just shoot you when you turn around, you bastard. Right? Yeah, I did that too. See? Don't talk back to authority, and don't tell daddy anything, which translates into don't tell anybody anything. Stuff it. Bury it. Don't tell anybody anything. Don't tell anybody how you feel. You might get beat up about it. Now we'll skip very quickly over to my first string. This is real important. I graduated from high school. I was out of school 2 years. I went to 12 years of school in 5.5 years. I started 10, finished at 15.5. My IQ is way over 200. Don't have a lick of common sense. That's what you people are teaching me at Alcoholics Anonymous. Just plain common sense. I don't have that. I'm learning it. And that's what I love about you. And by the way, I forgot, and I didn't want to do that. I forgot to thank the committee for their graciousness. I have been so nicely treated this weekend. I want to thank Chris for running out at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night and getting me a burger. He didn't have to do that, the kid, but he did it. I was so hungry. I hadn't eaten all day. I'm a diabetic. That's all I had to say to him is, Chris, I'm sorry. I'm a diabetic. I got to eat. And I really didn't tell him that. I think I told Susan. And boom, 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 it was right there. Thank you. I want to thank all the speakers. I want to thank him. Sorry I miss Lisa. Lisa's very precious to me. Very, very precious to me. Oh. We go back a long way. And she's always revealed herself to me. That's what I love about Lisa. You know? Billy. God, I can't thank you enough, Billy. Beautiful message you gave us. Eileen. a nice message of recovery, of hope. You know, I'm glad speakers let you know that everything is not peaches and cream and into recovery. I'm so glad of that. And then I had the honor of hearing Debbie. Debbie gave a beautiful message. I love to hear a recovering person who has suffered at the hands of this disease. I was privileged enough to attend a beautiful relationship workshop where men and women got up and spilled their guts and trusted us not to hurt them. And so I thank you for that. I am going to carry much more away from this convention that I am giving. This little pissy-ass amount that I'm giving you today is nothing compared to the gift you've given to me. So just to set the record straight. Now I'll go on with my sad-ass story. So I'm 2.5 years out of high school, and I'm going down to the beach with a dog. That's all I can tell you about dog. I was so ugly, so physically ugly. And maybe I wasn't, but I believed I was ugly, therefore I was ugly. I was painfully thin. I weighed 89 pounds, 5'6". I had a terminal and chronic case of the zits. And it wasn't the little blackheads. It was the big purple kind with the white pussy heads. And I had them all over my cheeks, one always on my nose, one right here between, and my eyebrows grew across just like a good little WAP Indian girl should look, you know, with all that excess hair. And I looked like John L. Lewis with these bushy eyebrows, you know. And in those days, a southern woman, see, there's a lot of myths about Southern women, and back in those days, you could be a lot of things, but to be a Southern woman, you could not be an alcoholic. You couldn't wear sleeveless dresses. You couldn't shave under your arms. You couldn't shave your legs because, you know, the only thing you had to look forward to was marrying well. That was the greatest, the highest heights you could attain was marrying well. And if you got the reputation of being a loose woman, you blew your chances of marrying well. So God forbid anybody would ever say that you were a loose woman. Well, Christ, by the time I was 10 years old, I was already known as a loose woman. See? So I finally, my father got me this date. And it was dog. He was about 30, and he had 3 bellies and 3 chins. And I said to my father, I can't sleep with him. My father says, and because I thought my father was planning a marriage. And I said, I can't sleep with him. He's so ugly. And my father hit me on my face. My father did that only 2 times, hit me in my life. So I went out with dog. And we got down to the beaches, and there's this, you know, there's this magical kind of zone at this one point in the road. If you go to the right, it's where the decent white women, families, ladies went. And if you went to the left in the road, it's where the honky-tonks and the beer bars and the hillbillies and the country and western music, you know, lay your head upon my shoulder, help me make it through the night, you know, gambling, and loose women went too. And we got down to the Y on the road, and old dog went to the left. And I thought, my father's going to kill you. My father's going to kill you if he finds out you're taking me to North Beach, Maryland. And we went to a place called Ewald's. I see, you never forget your first drink. And I walked in. My heart was going boom, 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 boom. I was so excited. I think I was addicted to action even then, see. And we walked in. He bought me a Miller High Life beer. My God, cold, wet, delicious. Oh, man, got it in my mouth, my lips were quivering, my teeth was chattering, hadn't even swallowed the shit yet, loved it, loved it, loved it. I loved the smell of urine and old stale beer. It's better than Giorgio Armani. I mean, God, it's nothing like the smell of an old bar, you know? It's like aphrodisiac to an alcoholic. Jesus, it's a turn on. I mean, I sometimes think about going, man, I used to look good, boys. I mean, I haven't never been always this fat and this old. Man, I used to get my black underwear on, honey. Oof, God, and them, and garter belts, you know, and them black hose up to there, you know, and then push them up bra, you know, get them titties out, you know. Man! And I'd get that black dress on, get that old red hair all poofed out, you know, and I'd go to the bar on Friday night. As soon as I put my hand on the doorknob, shit, it was instant electricity. I mean, the damn electricity would be running up my arm into my heart, zap me right in my heart, boom, 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 the adrenaline. I hadn't even gotten the goddamn bar yet. I was so excited. I mean, my, think of it. It was dim light, cool, sad. Liquor, gambling, intrigue. My God, I mean, man, for what, a price of a beer? Wow, no wonder we went there so much. You know? And so I, that day, discovered my first God. I discovered my first God. It was Miller High Life beer. It was cold, wet, delicious, and worked every goddamn time. Sex was nice. Don't get me wrong. Sex was nice, but sometimes the men didn't work. Especially if they had enough of that Miller High Life beer in them. That old pegger just... We better get spiritual now. But the alcohol always worked. It always worked. It did the number, and the number was, the deal was that it always performed, was that it took this shy, frightened, skinny, introverted little girl, and you jested enough out of it, and all of a sudden you had Gina Lola Brigida and Sophia Loren and God, Mamie Van Doren and Marilyn Monroe all wrapped up into one tight little package called Patty. Wow! And the zits fell away, and the hair that was long enough to plait under my arms, it was just like I was a silken, oh, goddess, man, I was satin all over. And I could talk without stuttering, and I could dance, and I could tell jokes, and you laughed. And I thought, Jesus, I thought this was the elixir of the gods. Well, you've been hiding this stuff. It's great. And that was my first love affair. And it continued for 22 years because for a lot of years, alcohol worked. Now, there's some things I missed along the way. I don't know if I intentionally did. I have no idea. I have to tell you about my one experience with drugs. And it's so funny. I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was 1963. Had a ton of money. I had made a pile of money. And after this is over, some ignorant bastard's going to come up and ask me how I made that money. I mean, think. Jesus. I'll tell you a little joke to tell you if you can't figure it out. There's a little girl sitting on the corner, you know. And as the little boys go by, she says, if you give me a quarter, I'll show you my snatch. So the little boys give her a quarter, and she lifts up her dress, and they go, look at it like that. And she pulled down her dress. At the end of the day, she went into Baskin-Robbins, got an ice cream cone, sitting there licking her ice cream, licking her ice cream cone, pulls up her dress, looks down her snatch, says, honey, you precious little thing, if you had a tongue, I'd give you a lick. Now you know how I made all that money. Anyway, my first home group was in Chicago was the construction workers. And then I joined, they changed the name to the tradespeople. Since I was a member of the oldest known trade, they changed it to tradespeople's move. Anyway, getting back to my sad story here. So alcohol worked. And for a lot of years it worked. I was telling you about my first drug.
Drug.
I went to, in 1963, I was living in Pittsburgh, and I went to the doctor, and I said, I go to AA. I can't stay sober. I said, I drink too much. I need help. I drink too much. 1963. And he says, I got just the thing for you, and he wrote me out a prescription. And I went to the drugstore, and I'm smart. I can read Latin. I know Latin. And in Latin, it means freedom, liberty. And I thought, what a lovely name for a drug, liberty, freedom. I went home and I took this green and black capsule, 20 milligrams of this Liberty, of this Librium, and I slept for 3 days by myself. Don't make any money sleeping by yourself, honey. And it so scared me. And the thing that scared me about this pill was that it was loss of control. And I know today I'm a control addict. I am. I love controlling. I love manipulating. And that little green and black thing had control over my life. I threw those things down the toilet. That's my only experience. I've never smoked a cigarette. I wouldn't know how to roll a joint. I heard somebody saying they could roll the nicest joints in the whole world. I didn't even know what it looked like. I was sober 2 years, and the police came to bust me for life. I was on life parole from prison. And they came in with this weed in their hand, this long, long weed in their hand. They said, Patty Citro? And I said, yes. They said, we're violating your parole. And my son came in. He says, leave her alone. She doesn't even know what the hell that is. And my son said, take me to jail. He said, Ma, it's marijuana. I'm growing marijuana out in the yard. I said, what? That feather, you know, marijuana is a feathery, beautiful plant. I'm enjoying growing. I thought it was the kid was into horticulture, you know? What the hell did I know? I'd never seen marijuana. Shit, you know? Today, my kids have to teach me about cocaine and rocks, and I keep thinking in pounds. And they said, Patty, think grams, maybe, you know, if you're lucky, you know? And the kids that I sponsor, they have to teach me about that because I have to be able to relate to new people coming into the program. Anyway, so I found alcohol. And alcohol allowed me to be pretty. It allowed me to be sexy. It allowed me to be a businesswoman. It allowed me to do a lot of things. And for the first time, it did its job every day. I was able to function. I never once drank to get falling down blind drunk. I was a party girl. I was life. I wanted to have fun. Somebody said they took, Ripple and Reds, and they couldn't see paying all that money to cocaine to stay asleep, to stay awake. I couldn't see people that would put needles in their arms to go to sleep. Who in the hell wants to sleep, man? His life. And I was addicted to life. I love, even today, I love life. I want to win. I want to live. I was in the hospital last October. Silly thing, like a goddamn heart attack. I'm on my way to work. I'm driving down the Dan Ryan in Chicago on my way to work. 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning. 9 o'clock, I'm late for work a lot. And my circumstances started going boom, 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 and here, you know, it wasn't going boom, boom, boom the way it's supposed to go boom, boom, boom. And I thought, shit, I think I'm having a heart attack. And the old controller, Patty, said, well, Mercy Hospital is at 29th Street, but Rush Presbyterian is better if you got a heart attack. So I drove from 95th Street down to about 12th Street, down to Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, got off, parked the car, got my ticket because I knew I needed to validate it. Went into the lobby, and the woman said, yes, can we help you? I said, I think I'm having a little heart attack. And she said, sit down. They wheeled me into the emergency room. I'm very impressed by Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's. They put an IV in me, was taking my blood pressure, and had the EKGs on me before they had my insurance card out of my wallet. Now, that's real impressive. Yeah. But I did have a heart attack, and I was in the hospital for a while. How the hell did we get off on that one? We gotta get spiritual here. Okay, alcohol stopped working. at some point in the longer line, now I'm going to tell you my number one chief character defect, and I found this out by doing a fourth step inventory. I found it out by doing a fifth step of my fourth step inventory with my sponsor. I strongly suggest you do fifth steps with your sponsor. That's my personal opinion. And I found out that my chief number one character defect is self-centered fear. That's my number one. But it comes out in different ways. And just when I think I have one area plugged up, God and I have one area of my self-centered fear plugged up, comes another one. Now, power has always been a big issue with me. And I want to tell you a story because it's very important. Back in the 50s, there was this fellow by the name of George Jorgensen that snuck out of the United States, went over to Sweden, I think, came back as Christine Jorgensen. And I read that in the paper, and I knew that when I got old enough that Patricia Ann Tarantino was going to go over to Sweden and come back as Patrick Tarantino one of these days. I had no penis envy. I've never had penis envy. But God damn it, I wanted something you men have, and it was called fucking power. Women didn't have power, and we still don't have power. We're getting it, but we still don't have it. But I wanted what you men had. I saw my mafia father have it, and I wanted power. So when I drank, I made a lot of money, and I set out to make a lot of money. And you know why I made a lot of money? Because money can buy power. You may have enough money. So all my life I've wanted power, power, power. And the more I got into my disease of alcoholism, the more I regressed into alcoholism, the less I lost the power. So I started finding out that by carrying a 38, I got power. You know, when somebody's standing there, a little skinny broad, 89 pounds, 5'6", is standing there and telling you, I'm going to knock your socks off, to somebody like Billy or some big tall guy, you know, they laugh at you and hold you by your head while you're swinging in the air. See, but when you whip out a 38, you get their attention real quick. It's a spiritual experience. And toward the end, I became like most of the people in this room, I became a loner. I just wanted to be left alone. I went to the bars to be left alone. I wanted to drink. That's all I wanted, was just to drink and be left alone. And men would come over. I was still kind of good looking in those days. And men would come over and say, hey, let me buy you a drink. I'd say, leave me alone. And the bartender would go over and say, you better leave her alone. Say, you better leave her alone. And, you know, it's challenge. Some men like challenges. You know, a lot of men like challenges. A lot of women like challenges. They come over again. Honey, can I buy you a drink? I'd say, I'm only going to tell you one more time. Leave me alone. And they'd come over the third time, and I thought, hey, all's fair in love and war. I warned you two times, bastard, draw up my 38, shoot the kneecap off. And the kind of bars I went to, the bartender would look over the guy and said, see, I told you to leave her alone. And nobody would call the cops. It was that kind of bar. I think probably David knows what I'm talking about. It's that kind of bar. You know, they'd ask him to leave, not me. And I went to start going to prison. You know, you shoot people, you start going to prison. It's just a thing like this. And my father kept getting me out. And I'd go to prison, and he'd keep getting me out. And the last time I went to prison was in Lowell, in 1972. And my father had warned me in my life there was a couple places I couldn't go in the United States and be safe. One was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and one was Tampa, Florida. Well, the first place I went to in the early 60s was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, married the son of my father's mortal enemy, just to spite my father's ass, because he had disowned me and thrown me out of his house when I was 17 years old. After that, I went to Tampa, Florida, just to spite the bastard, see. This wonderful father of mine, every time he would get mad at me or disappointed in me, which was very often, he would point his finger at me and say, you'll probably turn out to be the no-good whore your mother is. And I thought, well, as long as I'm going to have to wear the name, I'll show you, you son of a bitch. And I tried rubbing his nose in my life, all my life. And in 1972, I was sentenced to 4 counts of murder, 1 for cops. I was guilty. And they tacked on a fifth sentence of being a habitual criminal, and I was sentenced to life imprisonment. And the only reason I didn't get the electric chair was because they had thrown the death penalty out, Supreme Court had. And he got me out one more time. And he let it be known that this was it, that he had washed his hands in me. He no longer cared whether I lived or died. And I had always gone to AA. I told you this. And by this time, now I'm living up underneath a freezer box, and up underneath a bridge in a freezer box, drinking rubbing alcohol, weighed 385 pounds of syphilis and pus, no hair, no teeth, no fingernails, and nothing that resembled a human being, much less a woman. And my God deserted me. My God alcohol had deserted me. My God alcohol no longer did what it had done. And I think that's why we drink. The big book says that's why we drink. We drink for the effect. We drank because when we ingested that drug, and whether it's alcohol or drugs or food or sex or gambling or whatever your drug of choice is, see, it stopped working for you. And if it had not stopped working for you, my God, you wouldn't be sitting in Nashville, Tennessee on a Sunday morning in this goddamn room listening to some nutcase telling you about a sad-ass story if it was still working for you, and apparently it's not working for you anymore. So welcome home, honey. Welcome home. Sorry. Okay. Better make this short because I'll talk all day long. Oh, my God. Look what time it is. Anyway, on that day, February the 8th, 1977, I said something that I really had never said before. Oh, I'd prayed. God, we all pray. Don't we all pray? God, get me out of this. I'll never do it again. Or, Jesus, oh, please help me. Please help me. My God, what did I do? What did I do? I didn't mean to do it. Things like that. And on that morning, all I could say was, dear God, help me. Dear God, help me. And then I remember thinking, I didn't even say it out loud. I remember thinking, I'm going to do what I'm told to do. And people who are not alcoholics have always asked me, well, Patty, what happened on that day? What happened on that day? What was different on that day that was different from any other day in Alcoholics Anonymous? Doctors, psychiatrists have asked me. Judges have asked me. And I says, I don't know. I was tired. I just didn't want to live that way anymore. I just did not want to live that way anymore. You know, it's hard being an alcoholic and a drug addict. You know, it's hard. It's hard work. You got to get up. You got no money, no job. You got to get the money to get drunk or high. Of course, I don't understand dope fiends. I'm going to tell you now we're going to divert a little bit. I don't care. We'll take time. I don't understand dope fiends a little bit. You know that? I really don't. I'm going to tell you why I don't. I don't care if you're not interested. I'm going to tell you anyway. See, imagine it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, right? Now, the dope fiend is, he's broke or she's broke. They got to go out and chop something. So they got to go out and chase something. You're a second story man. They got to go out and chase something. And then they got to go out and risk being caught stealing. Then they got to steal the shit. Then they got to go and connect with their fence or whatever you call that person that's going to buy it or sell it or something. And then they got to haggle about the price. And some of the bitches needing a fix, right? You needing a fix, right? Man, you're getting all shaken, blah, 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 and getting ready to pee your drawers and everything, getting ready to puke, you know, and everything like that. And you ain't even got the drugs yet. You just haggling over the price of the thing you stole. So now you're down there. Now you got to connect with your connection. You call up on the beeper, beep, 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 you know. Well, you've missed him. Now you got to call back half an hour later and you stand there at the payphone. You know, did you ever be shaking out a drunk or needing a fix and you're trying to dial the goddamn phone? See, now, see, I'm an intelligent woman. This boggles my mind. And then all of a sudden they connect, and now the son of a bitch used to want $50 for the shit. Now he wants $70. Well, you only got $60 from the fence. Now you got to haggle over the... I mean, now this, only while you're shaking. So you buy the stuff, you go home and cook it, you know, and you sit there, and now it's 7 o'clock in the evening. And you know, come on. God damn, I know I got a vein left. You know, and you're slapping it, man, and you're getting ready to do it. 6 hours. I'm an alcoholic. I go down to the bar, plop a dollar on the bar, and say, give me a beer. It's illegal, you know? I don't understand those things. That's it. That's all my story on that. But that's okay. I just don't understand. Maybe then I've never had a rush either, you know. Anyway, getting back to this. Okay, February the 8th, 1977. I want to tell you about God as I understand God, how I found God today. God is not some white-haired old gentleman sitting up in the sky who has a book of good girls and boys and bad boys and girls. The God of my understanding today is good, orderly direction. And my God was a wonderful woman by the name of Katie Haygood, 38 years sober when she started sponsoring me. I would not have picked the bitch. They assigned me to her. I was in Lakeland General Hospital. I was dying. My heart had stopped. And I was in there for 6 months, not in a treatment unit. I was in there 6 months trying to stay alive. My pancreas, I had blown my pancreas. I only have 15% of my liver. I have angina real bad. They can't operate on me for my heart condition because I only have 15% of my liver and it won't take the anesthesia. So that's it, see. That's okay. You ask me how I feel today, great. God damn, I feel great, man. I'm just so glad. I've been living on 16 years of borrowed time, man, and you asked anybody, you ask somebody that's dying of AIDS if they'd like to have 16 years of borrowed time, man, they'd grab at it. See? So I love it. I love this life I've been given back. And they appointed this woman named Katie, and she came in and she said, my, what do we got here, you know? My. See? And I hated the bitch straight out, see? And she explained to me that there were some certain rules. There were no suggested steps to Katie Haygood. There were rules. And these are my rules. And if you want what I have, this is what you have to do. And if you're not willing to do that, go away and waste somebody else's time. You are not going to waste my time. And I thought, you arrogant, haughty bitch. I didn't say it, but remember I had said to God I would do what I was told to do no matter what. And I was hopeless and helpless, and I knew it. So this woman said things like, you're going to get up in the morning, you're going to wash your face, you're going to wash your hiney, and you're going to put a little, whatever it is, deodorant here, and you're going to fix up this little bit of hair you got left, and you go out and get a job. You get a job. She said, I'm a Republican. You get sober, you become a Republican. It's almost automatic, you know. You become self-supporting for your own contributions. That's, I'm just telling you what Katie said. Please do not come up later and say any shit to me. She said I couldn't go on the welfare and I couldn't declare bankruptcy. She said if I declared bankruptcy, that would be thieving. And if I sold any more, that I would probably drink again. And I owed about $250,000. Drop in the bucket, she said. Drop in the bucket. I was on life parole from prison, and they were getting ready to bust me back. And she says, you have to go tell your parole officer about your new way of life. And I said, he'll bust me back to prison. She said, no, he won't. Trust God. And I said, trust what? She said, trust me. And then she kept saying, God will provide. Every time I turned around, God will provide. And I hated the bitch, and I hated this God. So God became good orderly direction. And so I went and told my parole officer, and he said, you're in luck. Prison's crowded. I'm going to give you one more chance. One more chance. And so I did what I was supposed to do. I got up every morning, and I took a bath, and I tried to comb the little tufts of hair that were still left, and I treated myself. I backed into more penicillin, I swear to God. And I got rid of the syphilis, and I got rid of the wine sores, and I was able to stand up on my own 2 feet, and the hair grows back in, and the fingernails grow back in. If you get real spiritual, your teeth grow back in, too. There was a dentist. I got to tell you this. There was a dentist in Lakeland, Florida. He was 5 months sober, and I was 2 months sober, and Katie made me go see him, and she gave me a chaperone to take with me, not for me, for... She pitied him. She always pitied the men around me, you know. And he made me beautiful false teeth, and he put fillings in them. He said he wanted them to look more natural. That's okay until you get to Chicago and one of the fillings drop out and food gets clogged in your false tooth. So you got to go to a dentist in Chicago to put a filling in your false tooth. And he holds your teeth, and he says, who made these? And you don't want to break the bastard's anonymity because you don't want to get him in trouble with the American Dental Association, you know. So I started showing up. and I applied for five jobs. I had to apply for five jobs every day before I could go to the 2720 Club. Five jobs. I had to get up, suit up, shut up, show up. I had to get on my knees every morning before I even went to the bathroom. I had to do my third step prayer. Then I was allowed to go pee. She said if I did it in reverse, I would forget to do my third step. A couple of days I went to pee first. I did. I forgot my third step. See? And I went out and I tried to get a job, and I couldn't find a job. And after I'd filled out five job applications, I was allowed to come back to 2720 Club. Sometimes I'd be sitting in front of a nice-looking gentleman like Rick, and he'd be sitting there with his nice three-piece suit on and his white button-down Oxford shirt and his lovely tie. And he'd be reading my little one-page resume. It was nothing really. I mean, how do you put that you're a first-class prostitute on your resume? But I said, I'm willing, I'll do anything, I'm willing. And he would laugh at me, and he would rip up my resume in front of me and laugh and toss it into the trash basket. And Katie said that I had to go up and shake his hand and say, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to interview me. And although you don't have an opening for me now, maybe in 3 months you will consider me. Thank you again. And walk out of the door, and Katie said that I had to walk out of the door with my head high and my tits stuck out. And I would be sitting at meetings, and I'd be downcast because I couldn't get a job, and I felt like a useless piece of worthless whale shit. And Katie, I'd see her out of the corner of my eye, and she would go like this with her own chin. And I would lift my head up. And any man in the meeting that called me a whore had Katie to contend with. Katie said, we do not talk down to alcoholics. We've been talked down enough to out there. We don't need it in here. But she let me know who was boss. I got my first sober job, and I went back to my meeting, and we all celebrated and hugged and kissed. It was washing dishes for $1.15 an hour at the Waffle House. And God said I had to get down on my knees and thank God for my sober job. She said, you see, I told you God would provide. And I got down on my knees that night, and I said, dear God, thank you for my shitty job. And dear God, thank you for another shitty day of sobriety. Amen. And one day I was especially bitchy at the meeting. I remember Dwight Ellis, I break his anonymity all the time, he was saying, sounds like you need a drink to me. And he threw a $5 bill over at me and he says, here, let me buy you your first drink. That was my home group. I picked that $5 up off that table. I jumped up on the table, went over, and I told him that when he run out of Charmin, you son of a bitch, you can wipe your ass with this. That was a very spiritual answer I gave him. And at that point, Katie said, now precious, what a wonderful remark you've just made. Now sit down. And from that point on, I became known as Precious Patty. And I was not precious. And then I got another job cutting cloth two nights a week. By the way, girls, I had to go to 10 meetings a week. I could not be in a car with a man unless there was a third member of AA present. In that car. Sometimes I'd be walking along the road and here he'd come, one of the old farts from the meeting who hadn't been able to get it up in years and years. And he'd say, come on, Patty, jump in. I'll drop you off a block from the meeting. She'll never know. And I'd say, God, thanks, honey, but you know that bitch will find out, man. She got radar. And so I'd be walking down the road, and here's everybody going by, waving hello, and sometimes some of the girls would go by and pick me up and give me a ride. I could ride with the girls. See. And that's the way, that was the condition. I had to go to 10 meetings a week. There are no buses in Florida. See, 10 meetings a week, one every night, two on Saturday, three on Sunday. I had to go to the detox meeting every Sunday. She said it was happy, joyous, and free for me to go and help other people in detox. She said it was wonderful. First New Year's Eve I was ever sober. One of my girlfriends lent me a black dress. It was a drop-dead black dress. I had a pair of pantyhose that didn't have a run in it. And back in those days when my clothing allowance was $2 a week, having a pair of pantyhose without a run in it, or the hiney all busted out of it, you know, was wonderful. And I had those black pantyhose, and I put them on, and they were black, and I looked in the mirror, and I'd gotten down to 130, and my hair had grown back, you know. My skin was clear, and I had those pantyhose on, and I was looking at myself thinking, oh, tonight's the night. See? Tonight's the night. By the way, Katie had told me to zip the lip and cross the legs the first year of my sobriety. She said, we don't need newcomers telling us about their personal opinions. She said, if you have something to say of a personal nature that you want to talk about, I'm available to you at all times, but you talk to me. She said, until you've done the step, we don't need you commenting on the step. We don't need you telling us how you think you're going to take the step when you get to that moment. If you have not taken the step, if you have not applied the tradition to your personal life, then shut up. So I didn't get to talk much at the first year of my sobriety except on steps 1 and 2, which I knew a lot about, and step 3 because I did it every morning. So I was looking myself in there, and I put my black dress on my girlfriend had given me, and some other girlfriend had loaned me a pair of black pumps. God, man, I had long rhinestone droopy earrings. Did I look, man, I looked hot. I was hot. I was ripe and hot. I was just, man, I was fine. I was one fine fox. I tell you, I was just good looking. And she said that we were going to go out to a wonderful night of sobriety for New Year's Eve. And I thought, hot damn, she's going to let me go to a dance. First time I'd ever been allowed to go to an AA dance. I just knew it. I knew it. I knew it. Pick me up. By Christ, the dance was that way, and we headed that way. And she was taking me down the Bartow detox. And that night there was this girl, I shouldn't call out her name, she's sober today, and she weighed about 56 pounds, and I had her around the waist, her back was toward me, and I had her around the waist, and she was puking, and Katie was washing her face, and at one point Katie looked at me and she said, oh my God, Patty, aren't we blessed? And I hated Katie, I hated that goddamn bitch, I hated this whole scene. And at one point, the girl started puking again, and then she started pooping because, you know, when you're, you know, sometimes you don't know whether to stand or sit down or shut up or do what, and all over my black dress. And Katie was wiping her and said, my God, Patty, isn't this a wonderful way to give back which was has been so freely given you? Yeah, right. And I got my first sober car. So I'm telling you about God. I got my first sober car. I saw this beautiful old car. It was only about 4 years old, and it was a big old Oldsmobile. And it was only 4 years old, and they had a real cheap price on it. And the man, I went into the dealership, and he says, well, we don't know what's wrong with it. Once you get it up to 50, it runs fine, but it takes about 5 miles to get it up to 50 mile an hour. He said, but I'll sell it cheap. I said, okay, I'll buy it. And he says, is that cash or personal check? I said, oh, I don't have any money. And he looked at me and says, how the hell are you going to buy this car? So I told him my story in AA. And I says, I'll wash the showroom floors. I'll come in at night and wash the showroom floors when you close, or I'll clean out the toilets, or I'll sweep the lots, I'll clean the cars for you, but I need a car. So he called Katie up and he confirmed my story with Katie Haygood, and he sold me the car. And I worked at barter for the car, and they called it the death trap. Because you'd have to get a good running start before you could get it up to 50 miles an hour. So I went out that first night, and Katie, it was cold in Florida, and Katie says, oh, honey, it's going to be cold tonight in Florida. You best be at the 2720 Club early tonight. And I said, why? She said, oh, every bum is going to be calling AA tonight wanting a warm bed and a hot meal. And I says, well, we shouldn't do that, by God. We shouldn't let these old bums, these drunk old bums, use AA. See, I'd forgotten about me. And I said, we shouldn't let these bums use AA. What are we going to waste our gas and our efforts for? They're just going to call us up to get a warm bed. And she looked at me. I knew she was getting about to be a little testy with me. And she looked at me and she says, because tonight one of them may want it. So I showed up early at 2720 Club. and we got the coal. And here we went out, and it was the old Bartow Highway, and we went out, and here I was driving, Katie was riding shotgun, Don Golden and Johnny Kitchens in the back. We picked up that old bum. He had pooped in his pants for at least a year. He had peed so much that the front of his pants was white from the ammonia bleaching it, and he had cakes and cakes of puke all down the front of him. And they put him in my sober car. And I'm driving about the 30 miles to take him to the detox center. My Katie always let me keep a half a pint in the glove box because in Florida, sometimes you have to go 50, 60 miles. And if somebody's going into DTs, you got to stabilize until you can get them like to a hospital emergency. And so I kept a half pint in my glove box. And they started feeding him a little bit of alcohol. And I was praying the whole 30 miles I'm driving to the hospital and to the detox. Oh, dear God, don't let him poop anymore. Oh, God, don't let him pee anymore. Oh, God, don't let him puke in my sober car. You see how grateful we are for our sobriety? You see how we forget so quickly? And why I got down on my knees that night. You know, back in pages, what, 84, 85? What does it ask? Some questions every night you're supposed to ask yourself. Have I been selfish? Do I owe an amends? And every night I had to do those questions. And I got to thinking about that old dude, and all my prayer to God was, oh, God, don't let him puke in my car. It was no thank you, God, for letting me be a maximum service. And I got on my knees that night, and I cried, and I didn't cry very often. We're so ungrateful. You know, we alcoholics are. We are so ungrateful. We have been given life vitae back, and we are so... It amazes me. Especially when you want to need committees. Everybody loves these conventions. They love coming here. But they don't want to work for a goddamn year at these thankless, goddamn, pissy-ass committee meetings. And what do they give you? A little badge that says host on it. They wouldn't even give David a badge that said hostess on it. I mean, Jesus. Why should you work? You know, see, but we forget. We forget to be grateful. We forget to give back. And they ask you to speak, and speakers don't show up. Thank God these two girls from, what was it, Evansville? Just pop right in here and did the number. See? Thank God. Yeah, we've got to be responsible. So what is God today? God to me is good orderly direction. That's the only thing I can share to you about what my God is. It's good orderly direction. I get up in the morning, I pray, and I ask God to let me do the right things. And sometimes I don't do the right things. A lot of times I don't do the right things. And so I try to go back to you and say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I stepped on your heart. I'm sorry I stepped on your heart. And sometimes I'm right and the other person's wrong. And A.A., Katie said to me that I had to give people the right to be wrong. Shit. I like being right. And when I'm right, I want to rub your nose in it. But when you're wrong, I still have to love you and give the right to be wrong? Shh. Spiritual, stick your spiritual up your ass, man. I don't like that. See? So if you expected some wonderful flowery speech this morning, boy, you asked the wrong person here. See, I'm a flesh and blood human being. And now we're going to talk about 30 seconds on this business of straight bashing. Uh-huh. Oh, you didn't think you were going to hear it here, did you? We all know about gay bashing. Let's talk about straight bashing. Do you do it at your meetings? Huh? So why don't we just get the hell away with the labels? Let's just get away with the labels. Piss on the labels. Forget that I'm a woman. Forget that he's a man. Whether it was straight or gay or slightly bent or what the hell. This is not a man. This is not a woman. This is a precious child of God who has got a right to be here. This is a precious child of God who's got a right to be here. So what? She's not an alcoholic. She's an Al-Anon. So what? Who gives a shit? Man, when you're drowning out there in the ocean and somebody throws you a life preserver, what are you going to ask them? Are you a member, a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous? No. So what? Is a member of OA, O-A-N-A, A-A, G-A? We got Quad A in Chicago. Quad A. What is it? Alcoholic, atheist, agnostic, and anything else. We're a generic group. See? So when we get out on our knees tonight and thank God, let's just thank God for being a member of the human race. Let's try to love one another. I found this in Dear Abby's column, and somebody had them printed up for me. And I like it. It applies to women, but, you know, just put men in there instead of women. It says, after a while, you learn the subtle difference between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you begin to learn that kisses aren't contracts and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head up and your eyes open with the grace of a woman and not the grief of a child. And you learn to build all your roads on a day because tomorrow's ground is too uncertain for plans. And futures have a way of falling down in mid-flight. After a while, you learn that even sunshine burns if you get too much. So you plant your own garden and you decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, and that you really do have worth. I left Florida 2 years sober, and the bitch and I were holding one another and kissing. And I looked at her, and I didn't know how to say I love you. I still didn't know how to say I love you. So I said the next best thing. I said, Katie, how can I ever pay you back? Seems that she was a Republican. And they do expect to get paid back. But he says they have been paid back. And she looked at me. She was 4'11", and she grabbed my face with her hands, and she pulled me down, and she put one of the biggest, wettest kisses on my lips that day. Just big old fan. It was a big old kiss. And she laughed. She just laughed. And she said, oh, you will. You will. And never thought more about it. Got to Murfreesboro, Tennessee. My tire just blew up. I had my travel pass from my parole officer. I had the gas money, my meal money, and 14 extra dollars. And my tire blew up. I called AA. I said, you don't know me, but I'm an alcoholic from Florida, and I'm going to come in Indiana, and I'm on life parole from prison, and I only got $14 in my tire blew up. I don't know what the hell to do. And the old guy from Murfreesboro, Tennessee said, don't worry, darling, we'll be right out. Came out, they took me to lunch, bought me a tire, put it on my car. I went to Hammond, Indiana, my first paycheck, I sent them a check for the tire. And that's AA. How do I pay him back? When I was sober about 8 years, believe me, it was not a big amount of money. And don't you think it was a lot of money, because it was not. This little girl needed some help. She was out on her luck and on her ass and needed some help. And I helped her out a little bit with a little bit of money, because I didn't have much. And when she was sober a year, I gave her a toque, much like Rick gave me my toque this week. And it was so lovely that you did that. Thank you. And when I was giving her first year toque, she looked at me. She was crying. She says, oh, Patty, how am I ever going to pay you back? Well, I did what my sponsor did. That's the only way I knew how to act. I grabbed her by her face with my hands, put her the biggest, wettest kiss right on the lips, laughed and said, oh, you will. You will. Thank you all for loving me, and happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Thank you.